Hello, this is Alton Banks from the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as a Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. And we begin our weekly reading of the Triangle Business Journal on the biz page. And under the heading of Coming Trends, we find the article, Adding Co-Working Spaces Can Give Towers a Lift. What's next in real estate was the theme August the 8th when Triangle leaders huddled on the 10th floor of One Glenwood for a conversation about the convergence of hotel and office designs. Indeed, One Glenwood, with its rooftop terrace, exudes the feel of a big city hotel, and the panelists all agreed that adding amenities is a key step in the current environment. Ryan Blair, the Vice President for Development and Acquisitions at Developer Heritage Properties, said common areas were a net positive and helped in leasing. One Glenwood is already 98% leased, he said. And Sims Neighbors, the Director of Design for the Ratio Architecture Firm, pointed toward a revived interest in having work teams together. I finished college 25 years ago. At that point, the latest buzz was the office was going to go away. Technology was going to get us to that point, he said. It sounded great until companies realized they were losing any knowledge transfers between their employees, and people realized there was a huge advantage in that. And under the heading of New Push comes the article, Local Couple Wants Flags Back in the Forefront. Stephen and Megan Renborg are passionate about the city flags for Raleigh and Durham and believe others should be, too. The Renborgs have launched Civic Flags to sell flags and bandanas featuring the flags of Raleigh and Durham. Raleigh's flag dates back to 1899 when it was created for the USS Raleigh, a cruiser that fought in the Spanish-American War. The flag is a symbol that people don't recognize, and it's a symbol that's been around for a really long time, certainly in Raleigh, Steve Renborg says, but you certainly don't see it that often. And under the heading of Adding Capacity comes the article, Raleigh Firm Gets a Big Lift from a Private Equity Group. Global private equity firm Genstar Capital is backing up Insight Software, a Raleigh startup. Insight Software, headed by Mike Lips, launched a year ago with the backing of global PE firm TA Associates. Since then, it has closed multiple acquisitions, opened a new 32,000-square-foot headquarters in Raleigh, and grown to more than 450 employees. The company said August 14th that the addition of Genstar as a strategic investor underscores the overwhelming demand and market opportunity for real-time ERP-based automated reporting and analytics. And under the heading of Sweet Event comes the article, J.P. Morgan CEO holds a soiree at the Umstead in Cary. Biz knew something was going on August the 7th, after J.P. Morgan Chase CEO Jamie Dimon stormed into town to open the bank's first Triangle office in Chapel Hill. After some research, Biz learned that Dimon was hosting a private two-hour cocktail reception at the Umstead Hotel and Spa for some notable corporate and civic executives. He was taking questions from the audience that included SAS founder Jim Goodnight, former U.S. Army General Norman Schwarzkopf, and Shaw Capital founder Himanshu Shaw, among many others. No word on what Dimon thinks of the U.S. economy, especially after Wall Street's given back a chunk of its gains. And under the heading of funding comes the article, Local Universities Willing to Take a Shot at Spinouts. Three leaders from the Triangle's top universities said shots on goal are key when it comes to spinouts at an August 13th Triangle Business Journal Power Breakfast. Wade Fulgham, Interim Executive Director of the Office of Commercialization at NC State University, Rob Halford, the Director of New Ventures at Duke University, and Michael Klein, Director of Outreach and Technology Development at UNC Chapel Hill, addressed how they negotiate with spinouts. Halford said, Duke is looking to get as many deals and technology out into the market as possible. The MIT model of tech transfer is, don't negotiate so freaking hard on every term. Get more licenses done, he said. The big uncertainty in licenses is not whether you get 2% or 3% royalty on something. It's whether the thing is successful or not. The more licenses we can get done, the more chances that we have of getting success. In the last year alone, the universities have raked in more than $63 million in licensing revenue from 345 agreements. And lastly, from the biz page of this week's journal, under the heading of Interlocal Dollars, comes the article, PNC Arena is big winner so far in face-off for public funds. The month-long battle for the millions of dollars in interlocal agreement funds is headed toward a conclusion, with PNC Arena poised to be a clear winner. The Centennial Authority is seeking dramatic upgrades that would include a new look on the south end toward Carter Finley Stadium. That would feature a rooftop terrace and vastly improved concourses and VIP areas. It would certainly be different, says Tom McCormick, the chair of the Centennial Authority. The basic plan is to bump out the front of the building and take the space where the Carolina Hurricanes offices are now located, make that into a hospitality area featuring an outdoor-indoor bar and restaurant facility. The plan would also create spaces for meetings that could hold 300 to 500 people, then add more space on the north side of the building as offices for the Canes and for storage. The initial recommendation of the city and county managers was for the Centennial Authority to get $8 million per year for 25 years from the funds, which are generated from hotel and food taxes. But that was up to $9 million, a number that seemed agreeable to the Wake County Board of Commissioners on August the 12th. The commissioners meet again on August 19 and plan to vote then on August 20th. Both boards have to agree on a final decision. While it's easy to get lost in the machinations of government, the reality is these decisions have enormous implications. While other cities, notably Charlotte, imploded arenas and built new ones downtown, Raleigh is doubling down on an arena it opened in 1999. But a downtown arena could cost north of $600 million, and there's no political will to fund that. Meanwhile, the initial 20-year debt on PNC Arena will be retired September 1st, when the Centennial Authority pays the final $5.084 million. The authority wants to make the arena a more fan-friendly location, which is what Hurricanes owner Tom Dundon is seeking. The potential investment also raises the question of whether the city and state will give more attention to a Blue Ridge Road corridor still cluttered with state government buildings. Next, we turn to the banking and technology page of this week's Triangle Business Journal. And under the heading of More Competition, we find the article, Bankers Prepare as J.P. Morgan Arrives. J.P. Morgan Chase, which cut the ribbon on its first North Carolina branch in Chapel Hill on August the 7th, isn't the only out-of-state bank charting big moves in the Tar Heel State. Both Pennsylvania-based PNC and Ohio-based Fifth Third Bank, the 6th and 12th biggest banks in the state in terms of deposits, according to the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, have bold plans for the Triangle. And top executives at both of those institutions don't appear to be intimidated by J.P. Morgan's moves. J.P. Morgan plans to add up to 40 branches in the state, primarily in the Triangle and in Charlotte. Jim Hansen, regional president of the Eastern Carolinas market at PNC, says the appealing demographics of the Triangle definitely entice more competition. We'll see other financial institutions that want to grow in the market, he says. We're fortunate. We have a great footprint. We cover the market well and have been invested in the market for a long time. Lee Feit, the Charlotte-based regional president for Fifth Third, echoes his optimism. While PNC plans to look to invest in and maintain the branch network it already has, he says Fifth Third is working to add a couple dozen new branches by early 2019. You may see some before the end of the year, certainly into the first quarter, he says. We've already got a number of those under construction throughout the Triangle. J.P. Morgan CEO Jamie Dimon said to expect aggressive growth. We come in kind of with everything, he said. And under the heading of development comes the article Xerox. Cary was a logical choice for 600 jobs. Project Wildflower, also known as Xerox Corporation, has tapped Cary for an expansion over competing sites in Dallas, Atlanta, Minneapolis, Kansas City, Phoenix, Salt Lake City, Pittsburgh, Norwalk, Connecticut, Austin, Texas, and Webster, New York. With the proximity of tech companies in the Triangle, it was a logical choice, Xerox Chief Technology Officer Naresh Shankar told a crowd at the Capitol August 13th. The centenarian company, known for a document duplication, is creating a center of excellence that will involve relocations and new jobs, a total of 600 positions over 5 years. NC Department of Commerce document shows Xerox also received incentives offers from New York and Connecticut. It's an investment of $18.4 million by the end of 2021, including $12.2 million in anticipated property construction. Salaries will average nearly $113,000, much higher than the Wake County average of $58,138. State incentives could be valued at more than $12 million. Xerox is also receiving local incentives from Wake County and Cary and $900,000 in training grants from the North Carolina Community College System. They came here today and make a promise to us. We have to make a promise to them. And that promise is to provide them that kind of workforce, to work with them to make sure they're successful, Governor Roy Cooper said. And under the heading of After the Close comes the article, Exec Red Hat has maintained its culture after IBM deal. With the dust starting to settle from IBM's $34 billion buyout, a Red Hat executive says Big Blue has stayed true to its promises so far. The dust is no different than it was before, joked Michael Ferris, Vice President of Strategy, Products, and Technology at Red Hat. Analysts said their two biggest concerns over the deal were culture clash and neutrality. But Ferris, echoing comments Red Hat CEO Jim Whitehurst and IBM CEO Ginni Rometty have repeated on investor presentations, says Red Hat is still Red Hat. He says that with the deal taking so long to close, the companies had time to fully brief their customers. Overall, the reception both in the analyst sectors as well as customer interactions has been quite good, he says. Ferris, a 19-year Red Hat veteran, says the culture has not changed in Red Hat Tower under the IBM umbrella. I haven't seen any changes. I don't expect to see any changes, he says, noting Red Hat isn't trying to change IBM either. It's about finding out what this means, the ways we can work together. Our intent is to keep things as separate as possible when it makes sense. While Ferris can't comment on whether the marriage is already resulting in additional customer successes, he says, certain dialogues are happening and things are moving forward. Now we turn the page to the healthcare and education page of this week's Triangle Business Journal. And under the heading of expansion mode, we find the article, Durham Gene Therapy Company Acquires UK Firm. Making use of its massive private investment haul earlier this year, one of the Triangle's leading gene therapy companies has acquired a UK operation. Durham-based Asklepios Biopharmaceutical, known as AskBio, has announced the acquisition of Synpromix, an Edinburgh, Scotland-based gene therapy company. Sheila McHale, CEO and co-founder of AskBio, says her firm was interested in Synpromix customized synthetic promoters, which better regulate gene activity and precisely control protein production. Combined with AskBio's library of capsids and its manufacturing line, McHale says bringing in the promoters rounds out the last third of AskBio's strategy to be the best in class in all aspects of gene therapy. We'll have all the very best of the three components, manufacturing, capsids, and promoters, she says. But having the best would not mean much, McHale says, unless it was available to patients. She says the company also believes the acquisition of Synpromix Tech can improve its manufacturing yields, which would in turn lower the cost of their therapeutics. I'm all about making our therapeutics accessible to lots of people, not just people who can afford to pay $1.5 million for a therapeutic. All people, McHale says. Financial terms of the deal were not disclosed. In addition, she says that between the researchers at the two companies, they believe they can create inducible promoters, which would allow for the turning on and off of gene expressions at will. That, McHale says, is where the future of gene therapy is going. The acquisition is the first in a series of planned moves for the company, coming out of a $235 million investment from TPG Capital and Vita Ventures, based in Boston and Fort Worth, Texas, respectively. And under the heading of federal help comes the article, NC receives millions in funding to fight opioids. Millions in federal funding to combat the opioid epidemic is pouring into North Carolina. Through a series of awards from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, various North Carolina institutions have received more than $17 million in federal funds to help fight the deadly surge of opioid use across the state. The awards, divvied out through the department's 2017 five-point opioid strategy, include $5.6 million in behavioral health service support, $4 million for rural initiatives, $7.3 million for opioid workforce expansion programs, and $540,361 for graduate psychology education programs. For the Integrated Behavioral Health Services Program, the recipients include a handful of Triangle recipients, each of which received $167,000 grants. And under the heading of trimming comes the article, Novan to drastically shrink its space. After scraping by in a battle against running out of funds, a Triangle drug maker continues to cut weight with plans to reduce its headquarters by 70%. Morrisville-based Novan plans to hand over its lease to a third party and keep just 30% of its existing space. The company is developing a treatment for acne without the use of antibiotics, but has faced a litany of challenges along the way. The company has not disclosed to the third party, but stated it has received a non-binding letter of intent for the purpose of negotiating an agreement that releases Novan from its obligation. The agreement has a 60-day period of exclusivity, and Novan has stated it expects to reach an agreement by the end of the third quarter. Novan employed less than 50 workers at the end of 2018. The facility, located off Hobson Road near Research Triangle Park, has been leased by the company since 2015, according to its most recent quarterly filing. The 51,000-square-foot space was leased through June of 2026. According to the company's filing, the contractual base rent payments were $95,000 per month, subject to a 3% increase annually over the terms of the lease. And under the heading of New Role comes the article, New GSK Leader Carries Merck and Pfizer Experience. With the change of leadership for GSK's pharmaceutical business, the Triangle won't necessarily be losing its GSK leader, but his replacement will split her time between the Triangle and Pennsylvania. Jack Bailey, longtime head of GSK's U.S. Pharmaceuticals, has announced he will step down from his role at the end of the year, a role he has served in from Research Triangle Park. His replacement will be Maya Martinez-Davis, the regional president for Latin America region for EMD Serono, the biopharmaceutical wing of Merck. Prior to her work with Merck, Martinez-Davis was a 13-year veteran of Pfizer. Martinez-Davis is slated to take responsibility of U.S. pharmaceuticals January 1, but a GSK spokesman said she will begin splitting her time in RTP in Philadelphia starting September 15. Jack is an exceptional leader who has made a very significant contribution to the success of GSK, stated Luke Miles, president of Global Pharmaceuticals at GSK. As we continue to grow and reshape our business globally, we are pleased to have found a leader in Maya who will bring a valuable U.S. experience and deep therapy area expertise to expanding our specialty care capabilities and market presence. Now we turn to the restaurants and retail page of this week's Triangle Business Journal, and we find the article similar to Willy Wonka, "This Chocolate Has a Golden Touch." In a collaboration akin to the beloved film Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, Teddy Diggs of Coronado and Sam Ratto of Bideri Chocolate Factory have teamed up to create special gold bars to be featured on Coronado's dessert menu when the restaurant opens later this month. The bars are made with Bideri's classic dark chocolate and contain an edible 24-karat gold leaf, evoking a Wonka-esque vibe. When I was thinking about Coronado's dessert menu, I knew there needed to be something chocolate, and also knew that while the desserts needed to be outstanding, they also needed to be approachable, Diggs said. He thought about a shareable treat, something where people could break off a chunk that could easily be shared. "The best chocolate that I know of is Bideri," Diggs said. 1 in 40 bars sold will contain the golden leaf, which also plays off the signature gold crown featured on Coronado's logo. If you're lucky enough to unwrap the special gold bar, you don't get a trip down the chocolate river to meet the Oompa Loompas, but you will receive a ticket for a free pizza at your next visit to the restaurant. Look for other collaborations between Diggs and Ratto. "This will be an ongoing collaboration between Coronado and Bideri," Diggs said. Sam and I have already discussed some cool ways to expound on this collaboration so that it keeps evolving. And under the heading of Coming Soon comes the article, "Veteran Joins New Brewery Opening in Downtown Wake Forest." A new brewery coming to Wake Forest plans to bring Norse folklore to downtown. Norse Brewing Company is the brainchild of Chris and Jenny Jorgensen of Wake Forest, as well as veteran brewer Brad Wynn. For several years, the Jorgensens looked into buying a brewery that was already thriving, but they found many of the breweries had a different strategy than what they wanted. So in October, they decided to build a brewery from the ground up. Then La Foresta Italian Cafe off Brook Street, a mainstay of Wake Forest for over 25 years, closed. The Jorgensens found a veteran brewer in Wynn who had been at Raleigh's Big Boss Brewing Company for more than a decade. After his stint with Big Boss, Wynn also helped redefine the beers at Boylan Bridge Brew Pub, which has new ownership and is now the Y Hill Kitchen and Brewing. In the near future, Wynn will leave Y Hill for Norse Brewing. "They're all aware of what I'm doing," Wynn says. "I'm being as professional as I can. I'm helping them along with the transition." Wynn will leave behind the recipes he's crafted for Y Hill and is looking forward to his new path in Wake Forest, which he calls home. Next, we turn to the week's cover story, and it's entitled "Leadership and Political Squabbles Plague UNC System." On January 16, 2015, thousands of high school students across North Carolina and beyond excitedly shared the news that they had just been accepted to UNC Chapel Hill for the fall. And while those students were celebrating with parents and sharing the news on social media, University of North Carolina Assistant President Tom Ross was forced out on the same day. Many of those students at UNC and schools across the system had no idea that moment would serve as a harbinger of a long sequence of controversy and chaos that would define their college lives. Margaret Spellings would replace Ross, but last only 3 years. UNC Chapel Hill Chancellor Carol Folt was ousted after her decision to remove a Confederate statue after ongoing protests irked some on the system board of governors. Across the system, students would feel the impact of a university system that was more chaotic. The hiring for a new chancellor at Western Carolina University was marked by an unsteady search. At East Carolina University, Chancellor Cecil Staton survived only 3 years, and there were other controversies surrounding a student housing complex and a battle between its local hospital and the UNC system. All this has led to rising concern about the UNC system and the Board of Governors that governs it, with a statewide consortium of business and political leaders pointing to concerns. It's a broad mix of leaders from both political parties who say micromanagement by the governing board has led to countless instances they worry will tarnish the face of one of the state's most important assets, its higher education system. and with thousands of students returning to campuses around the state this month. These leaders are concerned that more missteps could be ahead. They also worried that continued disorder could lead to a steady degradation of the quality of talent and research coming out of the universities years down the road, spelling trouble for a state economy driven by the education system. But the state's supporters fire back that, by most metrics, the system is seeing a period of growth and excellence, with growing application numbers, research dollars, and even graduation rates, begging the question whether all of the controversy and chaos is doing actual or just perceptive harm. In fact, UNC System Board of Governors Chairman Harry Smith is quick to deny any charges of micromanagement. Unfortunately, sometimes you have to drive change, and this is not a space that traditionally has not been subjected to a lot of change, he says. Their idea of micromanagement is actually proper governance and oversight. In the North Carolina General Assembly, the popular target of criticisms, Senate President pro tempore Phil Berger says much of the criticism is founded more on political differences than on genuine concern. And he wonders aloud whether critics are more interested in the future of the UNC system or regaining lost political power through undermining a period of genuine progress. Some of the complaints you're hearing are coming from folks who were at one time on the inside in terms of what's being done, and now are on the outside, he says. You've got to take their statements with a grain of salt. But while the system's metrics seem strong now, some North Carolina leaders say even perceptive harm done by repeated controversies and back and forth between supporters and critics is enough to threaten the immediate future of higher education and could spell the beginning of a decline of North Carolina's prized commodity. The people of North Carolina, regardless of political affiliation, know and understand one of the greatest jewels in our state is our system of higher education, says Kieran Shanahan, a Republican and the outgoing chairman of ECU's Board of Trustees. They don't want to see the infighting. It's disheartening that Margaret Spellings was run off, and disheartening that we have all these other collateral issues. For centuries, institutions such as UNC Chapel Hill and NC State University have offered high-quality educations for North Carolinians, and the state system has steadily risen in national prestige. But the recent series of rapid controversies, critics say, has created a perception of disorder that diminishes the prestige of the UNC system and has created a long list of vacancies in critical leadership roles throughout the system. Those roles, they say, will be difficult to fill precisely because of that diminished prestige. I think that it's having an impact, says Chapel Hill developer Roger Perry, one of more than 200 influential North Carolina business personalities signed onto a public campaign for UNC system reformation. My guess is that many qualified candidates for these jobs are hesitant or reticent to apply for them when they see the dysfunction that's going on with the board. The hesitancy worries could be a detriment to the future of the system. Currently, the UNC system president and the chancellors of UNC Chapel Hill, East Carolina, and Fayetteville State University are in interim roles. The system has also brought in two new chancellors this year. Even Dr. Bill Roper, the current interim system president, seems to agree it may be more difficult to find top candidates. That's a risk. It's a real risk. That is that we turn off people's interest in serving in senior positions in the university system. I get that, he says. Unfortunately, I don't have a magic wand or an instant solution. The lack of an instant solution is people such as Shanahan worried. I'm a very hopeful, optimistic guy. But if the pattern doesn't change, the country's looking, and they're noticing things like Silent Sam, not just the issue, but how it's handled, he says. Or how do we treat a Margaret Spellings or the chancellors at universities? How easy is it going to be to go out and recruit top level candidates around the country when all they have to do is go on Google and read the articles? That long-term effect, critics worry, will not just be limited to leadership. I worry about the impact on faculty retention, Perry says. When really top-quality faculty perceive that their work is being micromanaged or observed at a micro level or criticized by, quite frankly, a board that doesn't really have the knowledge and experience to do those kind of things, I think it makes them question whether or not they want to stay and be a part of it. And having top-tier faculty at the universities has a direct effect on the business environment of the state. In the last year alone, the state's largest universities, UNC Chapel Hill, NC State, and Duke University, have spun out more than 41 companies, almost exclusively inspired or run by faculty. In addition to new companies, faculty research also led to more than $1.5 billion in research income during 2018. So many of our great faculty, especially at the flagships, UNC Chapel Hill and NC State, basically could go teach and do their research at almost any major university in the country, and in many cases, the world, Perry says. I worry about this meddling and micromanagement and focus on things that aren't really part of the academic mission affecting their attitude. In addition to new companies and research, the state also has to consider a central mission of academia, producing a talented workforce. The best and brightest students want to go to school with the best and brightest students and be taught by the best professors, Perry says. But for university leadership, it's workforce and research, as well as a wealth of other metrics, that they say is proof that UNC system is thriving. Since 2015, system-wide undergraduate degree efficiency, that is, the number of degrees incurred per 100 students enrolled at the university, has risen from 22.5 to 23.6. Five-year graduation rates have risen from 66% to 70.3%. And research and licensing dollars are up 10% per year. Roper says acknowledging that success, which he refers to as the cake underneath the more salacious icing, is an important next step for the system. People have said that the last period has been a pretty unsettled or even chaotic time. I agree with that, Roper says. When I first spoke to the Board of Governors at my first meeting with them in January, I said I had three priorities, and priority number one is to settle things down. I think it's a work still in progress. We're not done yet. He says his plan for recovering the system is one relying on regular process, a term he says he lifted from Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. The goal, Roper says, is to proceed with the task of governing the university system with professionalism and order, hoping to get everyone to a place where everything is not a surprise, everything is not a fire drill. Roper says he understands the concerns about the period of unrest, but believes fixing it requires changing the perception that is in disarray, noting that things have seemed to enter a period of calm. We can do a better job of telling the fulsome story about the institution, he says. It's a constant effort to tell this, because heavens, when you add together the students, faculty, and staff of the university system, we're talking about 300,000 people. It's hard to tell that in a fair and accurate way. But critics of the system say their concerns are not over the superficials. Rather, they are worried about the influencing factor of leadership outside the system, namely from the North Carolina General Assembly. Clearly, this has been the acts of the legislators, especially the Senate, since 2010, who have obviously slashed higher education funding in a draconian manner, have changed the rules to how people are appointed to Board of Governors and Board of Trustees, and have generally meddled in the overall operation of the system, Perry says. It all goes back to that source. You don't have to be very smart to connect the dots. According to UNC system records, total state appropriations to the system have steadily risen from $2.48 billion in fiscal year 2010 to $2.78 billion in fiscal year 2017, an 11% increase. However, critics say that despite increasing appropriations, the General Assembly has failed to keep up with the pace of growth. In the same period, appropriations per student in the UNC system have risen from $10,863 to $11,503. In 2007, that number was reported at $12,054. At ECU, Shanahan agrees that meddling from the political arena may be to blame for a long list of problems the university has struggled through, including a very public fight over the UNC Board of Governors changing ECU's list of suggested members for its own Board of Trustees. If Jones Street would just look at its assets and leave politics at the door, we could have multiple crown jewels in our university system. When asked to respond to concerns, Roper says, "That's a fair criticism. I won't try to push back at people. Folks finally remember a time in the past when the university system was beyond politics or above politics. I'm not sure all those memories are accurate, but if we could get to a time when people generally thought well of what we do and we didn't have any political arguments, would the world be the better place? Absolutely. Sign me up." People like Perry say overreach by the General Assembly has extended into their selection of Board of Governors members, pushing ulterior agendas. But as head of the Senate, Berger disagrees with that assessment, saying that board members are never appointed with specific instructions. "I don't think it's necessarily wrong for folks who are elected to a majority in the General Assembly to expect and to want people in positions that they have the authority to appoint to be in line or in agreement with them on certain philosophical issues," he says, adding that he believes the appointees represent the majority view of the people of the state. Berger says that he does believe that several of the appointees are pushing an agenda, but it's hardly a secret one. "I feel like the members of the Board of Governors that have been appointed over the last several years have coalesced around a program of trying to address the cost of higher education and trying to find ways to be as efficient as possible with public dollars," he says. He says he does not believe the General Assembly has taken a heavier hand in shaping the system, saying he believes the hand that exists is the same it has for the most part along. Berger says they hope to see fiscal responsibility and a concentration on lowering costs. "I do think there's a perception that constantly seems to be validated that in many respects universities are out of step with the people of North Carolina as a whole," he says. "But I don't know there's a whole lot that can be done or is being done about that." Chairman Smith vehemently denies that he or any of the governors are micromanaging or pushing secret agendas. To Smith, the recent years of UNC system have incited controversy, but he says most of it's come from a very, very small local minority, adding that many of them are the old guard. "That old guard," Smith says, "left system leaders with a long list of problems, including repair and renovation needs, with no plan to fund and untrained trustees. What happens is when we run into tons of emotions, these are the folks that have fallen prey to relationships rather than results," he says. "They've fallen prey to personalities versus performance." Smith says he believes that while he cannot convince a lunatic fringe of the good work the system is doing, the current leadership's guidance of fact, data, and details is the best course. Berger believes the majority of criticism is coming from a small group, saying many of them, including some Republicans, are merely part of a group no longer in power, making noise. "I don't think you can have discussion of this sort without realizing that there was a sea change in North Carolina as a result of the elections in 2010, he says. The party that had for over 100 years been driving the bus or riding the horse changed. There are certain people who were in a position to make decisions or be involved who are not in those positions. The more calculated approach to governance, Smith says, may be why some people have become so vocal. He says that the old guard could be the reason they have so much work to do. If you take a look at what we have inherited, in my opinion, there's not been a whole lot of governance and oversight. There's been a whole lot of rubber stamping and a pile of parties." In addition to this article, there's a set of sidebars here that talk about a timeline of changes across the UNC system since 2015. There are about a half dozen here, so I'll read them briefly. January 2015, University of North Carolina System President Tom Ross is forced to resign. In October of 2015, former U.S. Secretary of Education Margaret Spellings is named as the next president of the UNC system, sparking protests over the choice at multiple campuses. In October of 2017, the seven-year investigation of UNC Chapel Hill, which started with the football program, ends when the NCAA concludes none of its academic rules were broken. In July of 2018, a search for a new chancellor at Western Carolina falls apart following close involvement from the Board of Governors. In October of that year, Spellings announces her resignation just 3 years into her five-year contract. Then in January of 2019, UNC Chapel Hill Chancellor Carol Folt is forced out early by the Board of Governors after she has the base of the Silent Sam Confederate statue removed. And finally, in March of 2019, East Carolina University Chancellor Cecil Staton is asked to resign. His departure is more turmoil for ECU as a battle between the UNC system, North Carolina General Assembly, and Vidant Health broils regarding the hospital's governments. Now, regular listeners to this program realize that usually after the cover story, there's a column called Executive Voice. And that's no exception this week. The Executive Voice this week belongs to Meg Powell. She's an entrepreneur with a long history of experience in Triangle Pharmaceutical Companies, as well as an impressive recent history of exits from those companies. A graduate of UNC Chapel Hill and Stanford University, she spent more than 20 years working for companies such as McKinsey, Eli Lilly, GlaxoSmithKline, and Aerial Biopharma. After joining Aerial, she helped lead the sale of its top drug candidate to Jazz Pharmaceuticals. She founded Target Pharma Solutions the following year, grew the company to 75 employees and $20 million in revenue before selling it to Norwest Venture Partners in less than 3 years. Now serving in a strategic role for Target, Powell is far from done and keenly interested in local life sciences. And this is a Q&A as always, so here are the questions and answers. How do you see the life sciences sector here evolving? There are a couple of really interesting trends, not just in this area, but kind of at the macro level. One is this huge migration to smaller biotech companies and innovative smaller companies. In the Triangle, we've certainly seen this with losing a lot of the GSK jobs, with the Valiant acquisition and Salix Pharmaceuticals. These kinds of mid to larger pharmaceutical companies in this region have disappeared. Mid to big companies have a great role to play in the ecosystem. I actually do worry a bit that with those kinds of presences leaving the Triangle, that we may have a drought. That being said, we've replaced that, certainly with all the gene therapy manufacturing. We're becoming a hub for that, which is just tremendous to see. The universities are also just much smarter with regard to tech transfer and innovation and how to use spin-out companies to fill that void. So how's the funding environment for those companies? The organized angel networks now between the Carolina Angel Network at UNC and Wolfpack Investor Network at NC State University and the Duke Angel Network are tremendous. These strong organizations of angels, even in the last 24 to 36 months, are a tremendous asset for entrepreneurs, especially for people who are doing smaller raises, which is what I was doing. Once you're above the $10 to $15 million mark for a raise, you have to go outside this region. But when you're at that level, you're syndicating venture groups anyway, and geography becomes less important. What's the secret to making those small companies successful? Target was a little different play for me because it was a lot more people. We were building the company so quickly, and I talked a lot about culture. I interviewed every single person who came on, from the most entry-level position to obviously the most senior hire, because I really felt that I wanted people to respect each other. We talked a lot about our values of transparency and respect for people and commitment. How has being a woman impacted your career? I never considered myself a feminist. I grew up in rural North Carolina. I've always had great opportunities, quite frankly, and I never have felt outwardly discriminated as a female. I never really thought much about my gender. It was just, I am who I am. So being a woman, I just never thought much about it, and it didn't impact me until I had children, and that, to be perfectly honest, rocked my world. I was at the point where I couldn't be at 100% in all the roles in my life, and I had to learn when to make those trade-offs. The biggest professional decision I made, leaving GSK and going to Aerial, was a personal decision. I just had my first daughter and was traveling all over the world. My daughter was about 7 months old, and she got really sick at daycare, and I had to wake up and say, what am I doing? It turned out to be the best professional decision of my life. Finally, what key items are in your office? I have two things. One is a picture of my family, and the other is I keep every single business card I've ever had because it's really important to remember what lessons I've learned, both from the people that I've worked with in each of these roles and the roles themselves. And here's a short article from the business page. Under the heading of Adapting to Change, or rather under the heading of For Lease, comes the article, Prominent Chapel Hill Corner is Empty Again. A prominent spot on Chapel Hill's Franklin Street is up for grabs after another downtown business quietly closed its doors this summer. Medici Italian Kitchen, previously located at 100 East Franklin Street, has permanently closed, according to signs outside the building and a listing on the building owner's website. The site's being leased by Riddle Commercial Properties of Fayetteville with a rate of $31 per square foot for 5,351 square feet. The location is just under the well-known Top of the Hill Bar. Medici lasted a year on the downtown street, known for its high turnover rates, in part because of lofty rents. The restaurant space is a difficult industry in general, says Matt Gladick, executive director of the Chapel Hill Downtown Partnership. And premier spaces, like the corner of Columbia and Franklin, with their top-of-market rents, can be even more difficult for new restaurants. Only a block from UNC's campus, Medici had no shortage of foot traffic past its front doors. But according to reviews on Yelp and TripAdvisor, the restaurant often struggled to keep customers happy. Multiple reviewers complained of mediocre food and slow service. Next from the small business page comes the article, Humanity Must Be Preserved as World Moves to AI. This is written by Edward Marshall, who's an adjunct professor in management at the Fuqua School of Business and the Pratt School of Engineering at Duke University. There's always been a tug of war between technological innovation and the ability of human beings and organizations to absorb it. Four key technological trends need to be considered. First, job replacement. Kai-Fu Lee, an artificial intelligence expert, recently predicted that 40% of the world's jobs will be replaced in the next 15 years by robots capable of automating tasks. Two, the speed of technological change. It is estimated to increase a billion times in the next 30 years, according to tech experts at The Emerging Future. Three, the dark side of tech. There's a shadow side to technology that impinges on our freedoms and our ethical conduct toward others. Four, double-edged tech. Every technological innovation that helps humanity also has an underbelly. We split the atom to produce energy, but nuclear warfare is an existential threat to humanity. We invented the automobile, but CO2 emissions threaten the survival of the human race. So how do we come to terms with the power of technology so that we can also retain our humanity? People are afraid they may lose their jobs and are concerned about the privacy of their data. When there's a major technological change at work, the people affected by it are left out of the decision-making, but have to deal with the consequences. There may also be fear of the dark side of the Internet and how it affects their family and our culture overall. It's a leadership question. And while I don't pretend to have a complete answer, here are four issues to consider. First, ethics. In your code of ethics, leadership behaviors, and work policies, address the primacy of human needs over the technological imperative. You need to know when to say no to a technology if it will negatively affect your workforce. Two, culture. The values of the company need to assert the primacy of people over technique and address the fear by focusing on building trust, which is then reinforced regularly across the organization. Three, strategy. Address the speed of technological change, AI, robotization, and the dark and double-edged nature of tech in the company's strategic plans. How much change can your organization absorb, and at what rate? What safeguards and protections need to be put in place to reassure your people? What are the implications of AI for the future of your workforce, and how will you address that without undermining morale and productive energy? Fourth, ownership of change. Whenever there's a major change, engage your workforce in the decision-making and the implementation process. People take care of what they own. We face uncertain times. Technological advances can both help us and hurt us. Whatever happens, we must assert the primacy of human needs over technological imperatives to ensure the dignity, respect, trust, and credibility of our workforces. Next, we turn to the viewpoint page of this week's Triangle Business Journal, and there's always a guest column in that page, and this week's guest column is unusual in the fact that it's authored by four of four of former North Carolina governors, James Martin, James Hunt Jr., Michael Easley, and Beverly Perdue. And their article is entitled Gerrymandering and Separation of Power Can't Coexist. After 36 years of governing the great state of North Carolina, we have gained a perspective that few will ever experience. Although our policies and political viewpoints often differ, today we stand united on a matter that has critical importance to the constitutional democracy of our state. On August the 7th, we joined together in filing an amici curiae brief in Wake County Superior Court in support of the plaintiffs in Common Cause versus Lewis. Our brief urges the state courts to end North Carolina's partisan gerrymandering. We know firsthand that state government works best when it works together. We also understand the importance of representing the entire state as its chief executive. When the executive and legislative branches communicate and cooperate, they can develop creative solutions for the tough problems that our state faces, and they can reach common ground solutions on the issues that might otherwise divide us. Throughout our terms, we all experienced highs and lows in the functioning of state government. The highs came when members of different political parties worked together to move our state forward, and when all three branches respected the separation of powers at the core of our constitutional system. The lows came when progress took a back seat to partisanship, and when the legislature sought to expand its own power at the expense of the voter. Over the past decade or more, the North Carolina General Assembly has taken drastic measures to limit or eliminate the powers of the governor, regardless of which party was in power. Legislators took 1,200 appointments from the governor, required legislative approval of the governor's cabinet members, and eliminated the governor's ability to appoint trustees to the University of North Carolina system. They also tried to get amendments to the state's constitution to give lawmakers the power to determine who serves on an election board, and to allow the legislature to make judicial appointments. We vigorously fought those two amendments. Fortunately, voters rejected them at the ballot box. Today, partisan rancor and legislative attacks on the other branches are the new normal. The reason is partisan gerrymandering. Increasingly sophisticated gerrymanders produce increasingly partisan legislators. Legislators who are beholden to the sectarian interests of the party leaders who draw their district lines and the very small number of voters who are most likely to vote in primary elections. These legislators have no real choice but to pursue hyper-partisan agendas without regard for the separation of powers. And today's gerrymanders are impervious to the measures that constrain these partisan forces and kept our government on track in the past. By design, partisan gerrymandering impedes the voters from exerting their will and rooting out partisanship in the voting booth. And at the extreme, partisan gerrymandering licenses a legislative supermajority to pursue its most zealous impulses, trampling any other branch that stands in its way. The advancement of technology and the sophistication of computer modeling means mapmakers can draw gerrymanders with enough precision to make them unbreakable in all but the most extreme circumstances. And add to it the explosion of big data, mapmakers can apply their increasingly sophisticated tools using granular information about voters, which allows them to predict and control election outcomes with pinpoint accuracy. These tools and technologies allow either party to draw supermajorities, which allows the legislature to run roughshod over the two other branches of government. Regardless of party and control, our separation of powers cannot survive with a hyper-partisan gerrymandered legislature. It's up to the courts to end partisan gerrymandering and preserve the separation of powers. Time is critical. We urge the court to exercise its constitutional authority to end partisan gerrymandering now, so that the remedy is implemented before the next general election through an open, transparent, and nonpartisan process. The effects of hyper-partisan gerrymandering show up today in unforeseen supermajorities that have sought to kidnap power from the other branches of government and appropriate them to themselves. That's why we fought those proposed constitutional amendments last year. These power grabs by the legislature will not stop, regardless which party is in power. If the legislature will not fix this problem, then the courts must act in order to protect the powers of the judicial and executive branches of government as established by our Constitution. The article on this week's Viewpoint page is written as a letter to the editor from Courtney Crowder of Crowder Consulting in Raleigh. Development in the city of Raleigh is reshaping its downtown skyline and its corridors in most every direction. However, the southern edge of downtown Raleigh has all but languished. Thirsty for the type of economic activity that can invite and sustain a variety of housing, as well as office, retail, and hotels. Recently, Kane Realty Corporation and North Carolina Football Club announced that they'd found the answer, a 20,000-seat, open-air downtown sports and entertainment stadium. Their proposal outlines how the stadium can spur a $1.9 billion development called Downtown South, funded entirely by private investment. To make this a reality, they're asking Wake County and the city of Raleigh to allocate some tourism tax dollars, interlocal funds, to be used for debt service and maintenance of the $180 million stadium. Raleigh's experienced extraordinary growth over the last few decades, but too often South Raleigh and my community of Southeast Raleigh have been left out of it. However, the economic jolt of a project of this size will be truly transformational for our community. Thousands of jobs will be created during the initial stages of construction. The permanent jobs will follow in industries such as hospitality, sports management, and entertainment that provide stable careers with immense growth opportunities. Interlocal funds are designed to spur tourism, and it's difficult to imagine an investment that will produce a stronger return on the promise than Downtown South. A reasonable allocation of interlocal funds to the project will deliver this region a downtown stadium and surrounding development that otherwise will not happen. That's why I'm supporting this project, and I urge all my neighbors in Raleigh and Wake County to do the same. Well, that music means we've run out of time for today's episode of the Triangle Business Journal. I hope you enjoyed it. Be sure to listen next time. I'm Alton Banks, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. So that's 919-832-5138. So long till next time.